Welcome back to Golf Today. And this was the scene on Sunday as Aaron Rye's career moved into a new solar system. 68-foot birdie putt, par 3 17th at Aronimink. That propelled him to his first major championship victory at the age of 30. It's a final round 65 for the Englishman. The winning margin, 3 strokes over John Rahm and Alex Smalley.
How about the recent winners of the PGA Championship? There you see JT in 2022, Southern Hills, and Brooks Koepka, Oak Hill, Xander, Valhalla, Scotty a year ago at Quail, and yes, Aaron Rye from England at 31, breaking through for a major, which Shane Ryan of Golf Digest wrote a bit about last week. This was his tweet. My big take is that this was an incredibly weird week when everybody was wrong about everything, and as such, my recap is weird. Riding matching weird events. Unhinged. I call you all morons and buffoons, but I'm also implicated. The only genius is Higo.
Look forward to hearing the rationale for this one.
I do too. I think we're going to get Shane on the show right now. You called it a rolling terrain of horror. You had Michael Block in the Port-a-John, John Rahm's divot, and Garrick Higo's time travel. Did you enjoy the weirdness?
I did enjoy the weirdness. Look, I arrived for the first time on Tuesday, and one of the first people I saw was Eamon Lynch. So that was probably an omen that things were going to be a little strange all week. But yeah, you know, it was a bizarre tournament with a fantastic ending. So, I mean, we can get into whatever you want, but I really, Aronimink was fun in some very strange ways, I think.
So what is peak weirdness for you on the week then, Shane, in terms of how you analyze this one?
Yeah, well, you know, I keep going back to the Garrick Higo thing, and it should have been something so small, somebody kind of accidentally showing up late for their tee time. But when they got into the time discussion, as in, tee time says 7:18. It doesn't say 7:18:00. So if you show up at 7:18:45, are you still on time? I thought we got very existential. We got very into the nature of time and everything. And so I couldn't stop thinking about that. And I just thought some of Higo's interviews, like with Marty Smith and then in front of the press, were so funny on this very, you know, stupid little thing. So yeah, like things like that, Rahm hitting the volunteer, which, by the way, Novak Djokovic did that. He got kicked out of the U.S. Open, so I think Rahm got off pretty easy there. And then just, you know, the strangeness of everybody knowing that Aronimink was going to play so easy, that it was going to be a 20-under winning score, and then just completely defying expectations to the point that nobody until the very last hour could really break through. And then one guy did, and the guy nobody would expect in such spectacular fashion. You know, I can't remember a major with so many strange events happening, but it was good.
Should the PGA lean into the strangeness and the weirdness? This was a championship that used to be Glory's last shot. Now it's in May between the Masters and the U.S. Open. Should it lean into being weird and difficult?
Yeah, a tagline like things are about to get weird would really distinguish them. I mean, no, everybody's always kind of like wringing their hands over what is the PGA Championship's identity, you know what? And it's like, well, look, first of all, who cares? It's a major. It's always going to be a major. It's the fourth best major, right? That's always also going to be true. But yeah, why not? Why not lean into, like, we're the strange uncle of the majors, you know? You're only going to see us at Thanksgiving once a year, but we're going to blow your mind, and then we're going to leave early, and you'll never hear from us again. So why not? Sure.
The Bryson conundrum continues here as well, Shane. Leave aside his most recent moon landing conspiracy theories that we heard circulating last night. Didn't have a particularly good week on the golf course at Aronimink. It feels like he's kind of careening towards this career decision moment that looms for him later this summer. Where do you see him at right now in terms of his career?
Eamon, I'm sorry, I can't leave aside the moon landing because I don't think I've ever heard a hybrid conspiracy that the moon landing itself is real, but the footage is fake. I've heard various combinations, but I don't think I've heard that one. So let's leave that, though. You're right. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what Bryson wants to do, right? I mean, he's not playing well in the majors lately. And, you know, Bryson's always been really feast or famine. But I tend to think that if you completely go away from playing you know, professional golf at all or trying to be competitive on the biggest stage, I think all of a sudden your YouTube profile, you know, even for the kids who love you, that kind of takes a hit too. I mean, the reason you're big is because you've won major championships, because you're a great player. I don't necessarily think just his personality 5 years from now is going to be enough to keep people coming back the way it is for some of the other YouTube stars. So I tend to think, you know, Bryson ebbs and flows, and I think we're going to see him ebb again, and I think we're going to see him get really good again. So I don't think we've seen the last of Bryson. I think maybe he's just going through an existential crisis too.
But do you believe him when he says that he's having to make this momentous decision, choosing between YouTube content creation and professional golf? I can't recall a more momentous decision since Tom Hanks had to decide whether he's going to stay on Earth or go swimming with Daryl Hannah, the mermaid in Splash.
What a timely reference, Damon.
Thank you.
Nice work. No, really, I don't think it is a decision. I think it's a decision between, on one hand, you continue playing professional golf and you continue having a successful YouTube channel. And on the other hand, you stop playing professional golf and your YouTube channel peters out because it's based on your identity as a professional golfer. So, you know, I think Bryson must have some good advisors because he has managed to remake his image almost completely in the last couple of years. And so I think they would tell them that, you know, part and parcel of this internet digital YouTube fame is the fact that you are a competitive, great golfer. So, you know, you're going to throw the baby and the bathwater out if you just quit completely.
At least Bryson does have some options, Shane. He is out of contract with LIV at the end of this season. John Rahm has acknowledged that he doesn't actually have that kind of luxury right now. And Axios reported a couple of days ago that LIV is seeking $250 million with the prospect of becoming profitable in 20 months. But Bloomberg last night reported that LIV is also laying the groundwork for a potential bankruptcy filing if that funding doesn't come through. What do you think is the prospect of LIV surviving beyond this season, even if it is in some kind of zombie form where they're playing for pennies on the dollar?
I like sometimes, Eamon, that I know your exact opinion on this question, but you just kind of like throw it to me. Yeah. You're like, let Shane say it this time. Yeah, I mean, look, it's the idea of it continuing on in some zombie form, it feels like the only option, right? You're not going to have, I mean, unless you find the world's craziest investor, you're not going to have the same thing going forward. And so when you look at the zombie form, you're going, why? Well, what is the point of that? What is the point of having some minor league tour that you call LIV that nobody pays attention to, doesn't have any of the world's top players once these contracts run out? You know, I think really the only interesting thing at this point is if it continues on in zombie form, are they able to honor John Rahm's contract and basically imprison him until whenever, 2028? That would be the only kind of like they could make a funny sports comedy movie out of that scenario. But no, in terms of, you know, in terms of going on, it's for one thing, it's like, okay, maybe it's technically possible. Number two, they're not going to have any good players because they can't afford them. And number three, who cares? Is kind of where I fall on that.
Yeah, zombie form worked for Michael Jackson in Thriller. Not sure it will work in professional golf. Your thoughts on the next major championship, Shinnecock Hill, speaking of firm and fast. What are you most looking forward to? Scotty's pursuit of the career Grand Slam. What's top of mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, Scotty pursuing the career Grand Slam is huge. I'm really looking forward to seeing how he plays this week at the Byron Nelson because he's the only player in like the top 20 in the world playing. I think he's going to find his form pretty soon. I think he just had this really anomalous, terrible putting week at Aronimink. So I think he will come back. I kind of put him as the favorite at a difficult course like Shinnecock. So that would be probably, you know, the biggest sports story of the year, biggest golf story of the year, if he were to do that. And, you know, I think other than that, I think it's really all about the course. I mean, we had one of the funniest majors ever in 2018. Damon, I don't know if you saw that because it seems like your references all stop at 1990. But the U.S. Open was held there in 2018. That was hilarious. I mean, Zach Johnson saying we've lost the course, Phil scooping up his putt, everybody being mad. And so, you know, how much will they lean into that? Or has the USA or USGA lost their teeth? Are they afraid of making players mad and it's going to be easy? But I think Shinnecock is always tough. So for me, it's the course and Scotty and then, you know, kind of whatever other stories develop as the week goes on.
The majors, of course, Shane, have been boosting the purses over the last few years as well, trying to keep pace with this cash arms race on the PGA Tour. The purse grew by $1.5 million last week at the PGA Championship to $20.5 million. go back 5 years, it was $11 million. Do you see that as being sustainable within the game as a whole?
Probably not, you know, and then probably a lot of this is driven by Liv. And so once that goes, I think probably the process of trying to step back a little bit begins, because how long can you take private equity money? How long can you count on a when we have a new TV deal coming up, is that sustainable? Are they going to pay as much money as last time? And with the majors, I find it particularly interesting because, you know, these are the majors. I mean, if the USGA said we're paying $200,000 to the winner, I mean, maybe the answer is yes, but would people not play the US Open, right? And I'm not saying that, you know, that's an extreme example, but if you're the US Open, why do you have to keep going with the arms race, right? You are a major. You are a part of people's legacy. Everybody is going to play in this tournament. So my guess is across the spectrum of professional golf, especially without Liv driving prices up, we are going to see some steps back one way or another.
Shane, some were confounded by the fact that Aaron Rye was competing in an opposite field event before winning his first major at the PGA. We're headed to this two-tiered system, it seems. We're kind of living there already with the signature events and the other events. Are you a fan of the model of potential promotion and relegation that we may see going forward?
Yeah, I don't mind it at all. And I think one thing to keep in mind is that under Rolapp's vision, what we call the signature events now, there'll be more of them and the fields will be bigger. So, you know, instead of having 72 players, we might have 120. And so a guy like Aaron Rye might not be playing in an opposite field event. He might actually be in the main field. But no, I think so. I think as long as you have enough spots and you keep the meritocracy going, I think it's probably the best possible system. Everything Rolapp has said has made me root for him to enact his vision because it all makes a lot of sense. As long as there's opportunity there, because you got to keep that magic alive. You got to keep the possibility of someone like Aaron Rye winning the PGA Championship alive. And I don't really see that going anywhere. And in fact, as far as the signature events go, I see there being more opportunity starting next year, assuming Rolapp can push what he wants through. So it's not a problem for me at all.
Shane, it's always a weird, wonderful conversation with you, although I think Damon got a little bit weirder today than even you managed. But we look forward to doing this again before Shinnecock. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, don't sleep on the 90s, fellas. All right, stay tuned for more golf today. Coming up next, hometown hero Jordan Spieth. Back at the place where it all began, his PGA Tour debut back in 2010. What will it take for the three-time major champ to get back into the winner's circle? We take a closer look at the numbers next. Back on golf today, let's take a look back at the career of one Thomas Brent Boo Wheatley, 07, securing his first PGA Tour win in dramatic fashion with RBC Heritage, pulling a chip to save par at the last, and win by a single shot. Popular player, those were Boos, but Boos in a good way. How about this memorable moment? 08 Ryder Cup, Valhalla Sunday singles, famously energizing the crowd by riding his driver down the first fairway as if it was Secretariat. Down the stretch he went.
But on Sunday, the 52-year-old earned his first career victory on the PGA Tour Champions at the Insperity Invitational, completed 54 holes without a single dropped shot, held off Ernie Els by 3, and that was his first victory anywhere in nearly 13 years. His wife, Susan, there to greet him with a trophy. As Damon mentioned, 3 wins on the PGA Tour. 2 of those came in Hilton Head. Popular Ryder Cup victory as well back in 2008. Paul Azinger's team. And Boo Wheatley joins us now. Boo, congratulations on the win. I'm curious how a guy from the Florida Panhandle is finding Morocco this week where the PGA Tour Champions is playing.
Oh, man, it's nice over here. I mean, it's a little hectic with the traffic, but other than that, this is a cool place.
Your wife, Susan, said you called her Thursday night of the Insperity, and you said it was going to happen for you, that something had clicked. What clicked for you that week?
I've been struggling with my swing a little bit, trying to hit a cut, and I've only been able to hit a draw. And all of a sudden, it just, like, on my 17th hole practice round on Wednesday, I stood there and I was like, all right, I'm going to try to hit a cut, hard cut. And I hit 2 of them back to back. on that tee box, and then I'll get to 18 and did the exact same thing again. And I'm like, all right, told my caddy Cody, I said, look, let's go to driving range. Let's hit some balls real fast. And we went to the driving range and we stood out there, and I don't know, we hit probably close to about 100 balls with just hitting nothing but a cut. And it was like, that's what I've been looking for almost this whole year, really.
Well, it ended up being 54 holes of bogey-free golf, including that 360-degree putt at the last. What's this journey been like for you, getting back to good health and winning for the first time since 2013?
It's been a journey. It's been a roller coaster up and down. It's like having some hip problems, having back problems, shoulder problems, a little bit of elbow, and as of right now, as long as I keep taking them shots in my back, I mean, I should be fine the way the doc talks, you know. And so I'm hoping that – I hope he's right, or I can just keep rolling on like I'm rolling.
Did you expect to win earlier than this? I know it's only been two seasons really out there on the PGA Tour Champions for you, Boo, but did you expect success to come perhaps a little earlier?
No, sir. No, I didn't – I wasn't putting my time in like I've been. Like when I first came out, I really thought, you know, my first tournament, I thought, well, you know, I was going to get to see the guys that I played with on the tour and hang out with. We was going to meet in a bar and have a couple of glasses of wine, maybe a couple shots, beers. And I walked in there and I was kind of like, well, where's everybody at? And they were like, what do you mean, where's everybody at? And I was like, well, it's, you know, it's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon. They ought to be done. Everybody should be, you know, sitting around having beers, telling stories. And I looked, they said, go look out the front. And I looked out the front, and half of everybody's on the putting green. The other half is on the driving range. And I was like, what in the world's going on here? You know, these guys, am I deja vu or something? Like, we're back out on, like, the regular tour, back practicing hard, doing all the work. And sure enough, you know, that's what it is out here. I mean, it's game on.
Has it made you change your approach then to how you want to go about your business over the next few years?
Yes, sir. It did. Yes, sir. It took me, like I said, you know, I wasn't fully healed up when I came out, and then I finally feel a lot better. I feel more healed up than I have been in a couple years. But yes, the way I changed, you know, learning the golf courses that a lot of these guys have got to play for the last, you know, 4 to 5, 6 years. And now I'm getting to learn them and kind of, you know, going about my golf game where I practice. I won't practice as hard or long. I'll just work on the specific things that I need to work on for that course, or, you know, from them greens or wherever I need to work on that would give me a better chance of winning.
It had been 12 years since your last win out on the PGA Tour, Boo. What did it feel like on that Sunday? Did it just kind of feel like riding a bicycle and you're back in a familiar old place, or was there a lot of nerves attached to that?
I didn't have no nerves. It was unreal because, I mean, if you've followed my career, y'all have seen me 3-putt, you know, to win a couple of times on tour. And, you know, I've, you know, kind of just gave up a little bit on tour on certain tournaments where I felt like I should have won, but I just didn't putt well or hit a couple bad shots. But this time it was just like, all right, man, we're just riding a bike. I mean, we're just going to go out here and play golf. We already had 1 second. I mean, I finished second, but I'm just going to stick to my game plan and what got me in this position, which was just fairways and greens and make a few putts here and there and, you know, let it be what it is.
Well, your 3 PGA Tour wins came with jackets, a couple of tartans and a plaid. Where are those jackets now? They're kind of hard to display on a trophy case. Where do you keep them?
I really could not tell you where any of them are. At one time, I think my mom had 2 of them, and then I think my colonial one's actually in my barn, hanging up in my closet up in my barn where I was living at for a while.
Boo, you made your way up from the mini tours. You made your way onto the Korn Ferry Tour, PGA Tour. So whenever you were back on the Korn Ferry Tour, back on the PGA Tour, are you at all concerned that the pathways that were open to guys like you might be narrower for the guys coming after you with the changes that are coming to the tour over the next couple of years?
I don't think they're going to have the same path as I did. I mean, it's very unfortunate because there's a lot of guys out there, a lot of kids that can play golf that didn't go through college like I didn't, you know. that can really play the game of golf and love the game of golf and to better the game of golf, just like I feel like I have a little bit. And it's very unfortunate that, it, you know, they ain't going to have that same opportunity. And it's kind of really shameful to even say that they ain't going to be able to do it because, I mean, they're taking away, you know, so much of somebody's career or livelihood that you just, I don't know, man. It's hard to even describe that if that does happen, it's just going to be heartbreaking that, you know, a journeyman like myself and a lot of other guys that have played the tour, like Lee Trevino, you know what I mean? Like, just, I'm just throwing a couple of names at it, but I mean, there's a lot of people that didn't have the opportunity to go through in college and make it through the way that, you know, a lot of these guys do out here now.
Boo, you call yourself a journeyman, but you also competed in a Ryder Cup in 2008 in Kentucky, where you famously rode off the tee box as if you were riding a horse. Now, Justin Leonard told me he gets reminded wherever he goes about the putt he made in 99 at Brookline. How much are you reminded by people of that little move you made in 08, riding off the tee box on your driver?
I get it a pretty good bit. I had, you know, they hollered out there on at Houston. They hollered out me, wanted me to ride it off, and I like, man, this left hip don't hop around like it used to. And I mean, now if we had a Shetland pony, I might can get on a Shetland pony, but now a big pony like I was then, I can't do it now.
Do you still enjoy the grind out there, Boo? Does it still give you as much fun as it did 20 years ago?
I wouldn't say the grind as much as it is the competitiveness of it. I enjoy like the competition side. I love, you know, just like me and my close friend Heath Slocum, when we get paired together, you know, we're going to knuckle each other. And at the same time, we're both telling each other, I'm finna kick your butt today, you know. And I feel that with everybody that we shake hands with, you know, out here, you know, we're here, we can be partners when we get done and go have a cold drink when we get done. But today, right now, in these next 4 to 5 hours, I'm out here, I'm fitting to skin you up, buddy.
Well, speaking of skin, I know you like to hunt and fish. Boo, I was just on a boat. A buddy of mine, Brett Potter, caught a wahoo this big in Hawaii. Ooh. Had a scar on the side of its body from a bite from a cookie cutter shark. What is your best fish story of all time?
I'd have to say that my biggest bass I ever caught, which was at Cliff Valleys at the Valley Course in South Carolina, playing the Nationwide Tour. Me and Heath Slocum's daddy, Jack Slocum, which he was caddying for me at the time, we were playing our practice round. And as we was playing the practice round, we went around the side of this hole, and it had a pond on the left side where there was a big culvert that run out kind of into the pond off the side of the fairway there in the rough. And I just happened to be walking by there, and I looked, and I said, good night, what a bass. And I was like, Jack was like, where? I said, I showed it to him. And he's like, holy cow. He said, that's a good one. He said, how big you think he is? I said, I don't know. I think he's going to be close to about 8 to 9 pounds. And they were on bed then. And so we kept on playing. And when we got done, I told him, I said, hey, man, I'm going to get the rods out of the truck. We're going to go down there and fish a little bit if you want to. And he said, yeah, I'll go fish with you. I said, I'm going to go over there and fish that one fish. And he said, all right. So I went over there and fished that one fish. And this pond's probably, I'd say it's about a 4-acre lake to, you know, 3-acre lake, and he fished all the way around that pond, and I'm still sitting at the same spot trying to catch that bass, that female. Well, I caught the buck bass off of it, the little spring bass, whatever people want to call them. We call them buck bass where I'm from. And I tied it onto a stringer, and I stuck it over where the hazard stake was, keep it off the bed, kept it alive in the water. And then I sat there and fished and fished and fished, and it was probably about an hour, hour and a half before he got back around there to where I was at. And I said, hey, man, let me borrow your rod for a second. He said, okay. So I took his rod. I tied a big old jig head on the end of it, and I flipped it in there because she kept blowing my worm off and my lizard off. Whatever I put on her, she'd blow it off the bed. And by that time, I tied that jig head on there, and she couldn't blow that off because it was so much heavier. And when she went to go down there to it to blow it off, I snatched it real hard, and I hit her on the side of the head, and then I threw the rod down or handed it back to him, and I grabbed my rod real fast and flipped it in there. And as soon as I got it even close to that bed, she come and attacked it. And when she did, I set the hook in her butt, and I brought her on up there to the bank. And then by that time, the maintenance guys were out cutting the grass and all, and they seen it and saw me holding it. And they called for the superintendent to come. And then they brought a, like a, I don't know, about a 5-gallon wash tub over there in the back of one of them John Deere buggies. And we filled it up with a bucket of water. And then they took it back to the maintenance shed and they weighed it. And it was 13.9.
Wow.
What she weighed. Well, Boo, my biggest bass ever.
That's incredible. May the fish continue to bite for you, my friend. And may the birdies come your way. Enjoy the couscous in Morocco. We'll speak to you soon, partner.
Yes, sir. Thank y'all so much for having me.
Morocco, by the way, also offers world-class saltwater and freshwater fishing. Should Boo want to get some fishing while he competes at the Trophy Hassan? Do they see the rest of the PGA Tour Champions' upcoming schedule leading into that U.S. Senior Open early July?
Scotty Scheffler has played 9 straight events without winning. That's a slump by his standards, and he's going to try to break that drought in his hometown game this week in Dallas. We're going to hear from the world number one. And the most recent winner on the LPGA Tour is here. Lottie Wode made it a winning double for the English last weekend. Not today, moving into hour two.
Golf Today.
We're continuing here on Golf Today. I'm Eamon Lynch. He is Damon Hack. And Damon, in this game, you hear a lot of people say that too many golfers are just too vanilla as personalities go. But Boo Weekly, what a beaut.
What a beaut. What was more fascinating, his description of expecting all the players to be hanging out drinking at 1 o'clock or his fish story trying to catch that buck bass?
Well, he kind of, at least he struck out on the drinking part of it, but he got his fish in the end. He reeled that in.
Yes, he did. Speaking of fishing, Aaron Rye caught a big one outside of Philadelphia, 34-pound Wanamaker Trophy. Yeah, here's some of the incredible images from that Sunday outside Philly. Fine around 65 to earn his first career major, hugging his wife, Garika. Next to that Wanamaker Trophy, that final day included that clutch birdie on the 71st hole, which helped seal the victory. There's that big one, 34 pounds, that trophy. And Aaron, in good company in lowest final round scores by a PGA champ, just behind Colin Morikawa and Elk, and right alongside Xander, Jeff Sluman, and David Graham.
With 2 majors in the books, the PGA Tour is back in action this week in Texas for the CJ Cup Byron Nelson. Live coverage coming your way Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Golf Channel. Now, here's a guy who knows a thing or two about Texas. Randall Chambly. That's his real name, by the way. Man, Pa Chambly had a sense of humor about these things. He spent his college years at the University of Texas at Austin. One of 4 Longhorns to earn first-team All-American honors all the way back 1983. Still had spectacular hair, even then. Randall Chambly joins us now to do a little post-mortem on the PGA Championship, Randall.
Wow. And that brought back memories right there. Wow.
And your those memory doesn't some, go back that far some, in person anymore.
Woo, those were some 28 wasted polyester pants that I promise you, if I got near anything that was flammable, I was in trouble.
Yeah, 28 waist and 24 leg, unfortunately for you, Randall. Let's talk about the PGA Championship here. Aaron Rye, are you in the category of people who think he's such a welcome antidote to what we've seen so much of in golf over the last 4 or 5 years in terms of his sense of gratitude, his perspective, the lack of entitlement that he seems to show?
Well, I don't want to paint with a broad brush here and deem all of golf guilty of greed. But yeah, it's nice to see somebody come along who's got that much gratitude and appreciation for the path that they've been able to take and for the gifts that were bestowed upon them early in their career. You know, it sounds like he had a wonderful upbringing of mom and dad, and he carries that gratitude forward. You know, we've had some very popular wins this year on the PGA Tour, for sure. But I can't remember somebody winning a major championship that was so universally appreciated and loved by his peers. Ludvig Åberg, who was playing with him on Sunday, said, if I was going to lose to anybody, I'm happy enough to lose to Aaron Rye. So a hugely popular victory.
Brandel, the thought going into the week was, oh, this golf course, it can't hold these players. How did the collective we get that so wrong?
I don't know. I guess we looked back at the previous tournaments that were played there, so a lot of low scores. Obviously, it was soft in 2018. But the golf course was very firm and the rough was thicker than it had been in those events. And I think we just didn't really anticipate the collision of all of those things. The fairways were said to be wide, but effectively they didn't play wide. I think on average they were 33 yards wide, but they probably played more like 28 or 27. You know, they played narrow. And the rough, even though it was 3 inches, played like it was five. And the greens, even though they were quite large, played like they were small. And they were almost... I'm not going to say they were impossible. You had to hit a really high quality shot to get a ball close to the hole. So it really did differentiate between a good and a great shot. I can't remember a better test in major championship golf. I really can't, all the way through the bag. It held you accountable off the tee. It was important to hit it far, but not that important. You pay the price if you missed a fairway, held you accountable with a good or great shot or bad shot into the green, really had to putt well, had to lag well, had to read greens well, really had to make your 4 and 5 footers. I don't know if major championship golf's ever had a better test.
On this topic of holding them accountable off the tee, Brandel, obviously Aaron Rye did that better than anyone else. He was, I think, fourth in driving accuracy for the week. But of the 12 other guys who were in the top 10 or tied, Xander Schauffele tied 20th in accuracy, was the only other guy in that top 20 in terms of hitting the ball straight off the tee. Do you think it did hold people sufficiently accountable off the tee when you look at where Cam Smith or Rory McIlroy was hitting the ball for most of those last few days?
Well, if you miss the fairway by a wide margin, obviously you got a better lie. So, you know, Pod Geeter was up there early on, missing by wide margins. McIlroy was tied for dead last in driving accuracy, but he hits it so far. He averaged almost 350 yards off the tee. He was still able to get on a fair number of greens and still be pretty good with his strokes gain approach. But he struggled in terms of putting. But yeah, I loved the fact that it did allow for some recovery, because the argument for less rough is that it allows for recovery. And I appreciate that argument. I certainly appreciated Augusta National. You know, I love the swashbuckling nature that it takes to play and the creativity that it takes to play Augusta National. But I think it stands alone in that regard. That golf course is about slaying the dragon. It's about recovery. It's about bold choices and creativity. And that's great. It's exciting. There's nothing like the Masters. But I think the rest of the majors should test players thoroughly. The U.S. Open had a period where it kind of got away from that. It's getting back to it. The Open depends on Mother Nature. To whatever extent the PGA Championship has said not to have an identity, although I think it had one, but to whatever extent it suffers in comparison to the other three, I think this major championship would be a great template going forward as to just go ahead and set it up as the sternest test in golf, because that's what this was. You know, Scottie Scheffler led in fairways hit, but he putted abysmally. So, you know, it's often said, you know, you hear the banality trotted out when somebody wins a major championship, that he played the best golf that week. Well, from an arithmetic standpoint, yes. Okay. Undeniably. But oftentimes they got more than their fair share of luck, or they had an out-of-body experience around or on the greens that week, which, again, is to some extent luck. From a ball striking standpoint, off of the tee, into the greens, on the greens, he truly did play the best golf of anybody there. And so really is a worthy champion. And what more can you ask of a major championship than that?
Brandel, I can't imagine the difficulty that Kerry Haig and Jeff Hall and these folks who set up major championship golf courses face in this era of bombers and incredible equipment. And now we go to Shinnecock Hills, William Flynn, C.B. McDonald, and Seth before that, and Willie Davis. It is a cathedral of American golf. But 2004, we saw them have to syringe the seventh green after every group. 2018, Zach Johnson told us the golf course is lost. It's gone. Do you have concerns about how Shinnecock will be set up and how it will play next month?
No, I think they learned from their past mistakes and set up. And look, all they were trying to do was present the ultimate test to these guys. Yeah, the seventh hole got away from them. Maybe a few other holes were questionable. But in general, I would say Shinnecock has an extraordinary record of divining out great players. Ray Floyd was the 16th ranked player in the world when he won there. Corey Pavin was the 16th ranked player in the world when he won there. Retief Goosen was the 11th ranked player in the world when he won there. And Brooks Koepka was the 9th ranked player in the world when he won there. So that's a pretty darn good record. You know, Ray and Corey weren't the longest of hitters the last two. Retief and Brooks have been. And I think that's where it's likely to go there. You know, the golf course is a big, massive golf course with very, very difficult greens to hit. So length will play a bigger factor there. But I would just say that, again, Aronimink is a reminder that you don't have to go longer to keep up with the advances of technology and distance that players are hitting the golf ball. If you really do want a democratic test, make the golf course 7,000 to 7,200 yards long, put some thick rough out there, make them pay a price, and you'll get a collision on the leaderboard like we had this week at Aronimink of all of these different styles of play, long, short, wild, and straight. And from that perspective, it was very compelling.
You mentioned Scottie Scheffler putting abysmally, Brandle. That's unlikely to become an easier task with the greens at Shinnecock Hills in a few weeks. Is that a lingering concern in your mind, or do you think it was just something symptomatic of the particular challenge at Aronimink?
Maybe symptomatic, Eamon. You know, maybe it was his worst week of the year putting, but he's been missing an inordinate number of short putts this year. He's been getting off to slow starts, hadn't been hitting his irons great, although he was good, not great, at Aronimink. You know, you'd like to think that he can get those things sorted out, but it's been 4 or 5 months now where he's been prone to missing three-footers. And again, there are, the last time I looked, which was before Aronimink, there were something, almost 60 players on tour who hadn't missed a three-footer all year long. And it's not a small data size. You know, some of them had made 450 out of 450. You know, it's rare when tour players miss a three-footer. But it certainly wasn't rare for Scottie Scheffler at Aronimink, and it hasn't been rare this year. And, you know, I realize that when he's at his best, he can afford those misses. But he's not at his best this year. This is the worst golf he's played in 5 years. He's still the best player in the world. That speaks to how much better he was than everybody else. But he can't afford those misses, given that he's slightly off his game this year in terms of ball striking.
Well, speaking of Texas golf legends, and that's how we started this show, Jordan Spieth continues to hit the ball well, but Tripp Eisenhower had a theory this week that he's putting too much emotion into his own short misses on the greens. What do you think of that theory, that he's spending too much emotional capital, you know, flinging the arms out when he does miss a five-footer?
You know, I got all the world, all the respect in the world for Tripp and what Tripp's doing these days. I enjoy it. You know, maybe he's onto something. I would always say, though, that Jordan's always been demonstrative when he plays golf. He's always been animated beyond belief, talkative. He's the one player that needs no commentary. you don't have to say anything. Just lay out and let the mics go. He'll tell you how he hit it. He'll tell you if it's coming up short, right, left, long. It's great theater. His ball striking, I would argue, is the part of his game that's held him back. Over the last, you know, go back to when he won at Royal Birkdale in 2017. He's only won twice since then. Hasn't won since 2022. But every single aspect of his game has been good in that period and horrible in that period. He's just never been able to put them all together for 1 year. Although last year his statistics were quite good, but not up to the standards when he was, I would say, one of the best players in the world. Everybody pulls for him because he's so exciting to play, to watch play. But the thing that matters most with him is his approach play. If it gets to be elite, then he would be back on top of those leaderboards. But until his approach play gets to be elite, he's likely to be scrambling and trying to look for an out of body experience around and on the greens to win again or contend again in majors.
John Rahm and Cameron Smith both had good weeks at their round for the first time in quite a while in a major championship. Do you look upon it as a universally positive takeaway for those two guys, or did you sense any lack of sharpness under the gun on Sunday afternoon from them?
I mean, Rahm continues to struggle, and I say that with all due respect to Rahm's game. I say struggle relative to his unbelievable talents. You know, he's had some good finishes in majors since he's gone to LIV. This is the first top five he's had. But he was 47th, according to strokes gained data in Data Golf, 47th in strokes gained approach, and 54th in driving accuracy. Continues to be plagued by the left miss. He did some other things marvelously well there, so it was great to see him back again. And it was great to see Cameron Smith back again. Cameron Smith was back to his old ways of you know, scrambling beautifully, and surprisingly hit his irons great at Aronimink. Maybe that was due to his, you know, switching coaches. You know, he went to Claude Harmon, I guess, recently before he went to the U.S. Open. And that's good to see. I miss watching Cameron Smith play golf. I miss watching John Rahm play good golf. So it was good to see them back and playing well again.
Just a last question before we let you go, Brandon Lewis. One of the side stories of the week, Garrick Higgle. It's an interesting one. Obviously missed his tee time Thursday, since parted ways with the caddy after taking that two-stroke penalty, missed the cut by one. Did you ever miss a tee time on tour? I know you generally only had to worry about it Thursdays and Fridays, but did you ever miss any of those tee times? It doesn't happen often out there, right?
I can never remember missing a tee time. I can remember almost missing a tee time once when I got my tee time wrong. And then another time I had forgotten that Tiger Woods was playing in the event. So I didn't allow the hour and a half traffic jam on the way out to Cog Hill. And on Thursday morning, I had gotten to Cog Hill in like 15 minutes, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then Thursday morning, it was absolute chock-a-block all the way there. It took me an hour and a half to get in. I almost just parked my car and ran like Seve did back at the U.S. Open eons ago. And, you know, I was like, I'm an idiot. When Tiger Woods is playing, you have to allow for another hour, hour and a half of traffic. I don't remember anybody being on site and just sort of lollygagging around on a green and miss it. But, and I'm sorry that he missed the cut. I'm sorry that, you know, he and his caddy had a fallout. It was some of the most hilarious, nonsensical quotes I've ever heard, except for when you try to explain why you're such a bad golfer, Eamon.
Yeah, or my kids explaining why they didn't do their homework.
I just got to blame somebody else. That's all you need, really.
Well, Tom Coughlin, the great Giants coach, used to say if you weren't 5 minutes early to his meeting, you were late. So perhaps Garrick Higgle should take a page out of that book.
I say to my kids all the time, if you're early, you're on time. If you're on time, you're late. And yeah, it's a good rule of thumb when you're teeing off in tour events.
Absolutely. And speaking of books, looks like you have some books to catch up on reading behind you, Brando. We appreciate a few minutes.
None of them are Eamon's, by the way. None.
We'll see you at Shinnecock, my friend.
Look forward to it. Y'all take care.
All right, more golf today ahead. We'll be joined by LPGA Tour's latest winner, Lottie Woad. Continues to build her resume on the game's biggest stage. What's next for the young star this season? We'll find out next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Welcome back to Golf Today. Lottie Woad is in the early days of her career, but she's already accomplished a lot. She won the Augusta National Women's Amateur back in 2024. Three birdies in those final four holes at Augusta National. Then at the 2025 Irish Open and the Ladies European Tour, she won by six. She became the first amateur to win an LET event in more than 3 years. She began that final day with a seven-shot lead, finished with a four-under par, 69, to seal the deal.
And later that same month, in 2025, Lottie would win in her pro debut in the Ladies Scottish Open, and with the win became the second player in 3 years to win in the pro debut, joining one Rose Zhang. Then over the weekend, Lottie earned her second career LPGA Tour victory in the Kroger Queen City Championship, finishing at 12 under par, which was good enough for a two-shot win. And Lottie Woad joins us now. Congratulations, you're back in Tallahassee. Very impressive win, including when you consider you made double on six. Now, I know double bogeys happen, but what was the process of getting, you know, past that and making sure you got that second win?
Yeah, I saw the leaderboard at that point, so I knew I was tied, and Heyron was on a good run on the front nine. So I had a par five next, which I guess kind of helped. So knew I had to get a birdie back to try and get ahead and just focus on that, really.
Lottie, it was a pretty accomplished group of players behind you on that leaderboard with names like, you know, Jin Young Ko, Nelly Korda. They were all there. Were you able to put that out of your mind and just focus on the business at hand, or are you a leaderboard watcher?
Yeah, I do watch the leaderboard. I think it's always good to know where I am. There was definitely gaps in a few holes where there wasn't a leaderboard, so was kind of guessing on that. But yeah, there was a lot of good players playing in the tournament, obviously, but I feel like on the LPGA, most people can win most weeks, so it doesn't really matter who's chasing you. I feel like a lot of people can win.
So you win in your professional debut, and then all of a sudden the thoughts, well, she's going to win every week. Were there complications with winning so quickly? Did it put extra pressure onto your shoulders, perhaps?
I mean, I didn't think I put any extra pressure on myself. I knew that it's tough to win out here. Obviously, winning on my first event was really cool, but kind of got to see each week, you know, how good everyone is and how tough it is to win. So just try to stay as patient as possible. And then obviously last week was my week.
I'm curious what your mindset was going into last week, Lottie, because the week prior you shot 80, 77, missed the cut in an LPGA event. Are you able to just kind of block that out, write it off as a week where things weren't working, and then start fresh cleanly the next week?
Yeah, I mean, last week was a pretty tough course. It was a bit of a funky course. There was a lot of high scoring from everyone. So just tried to ride that off as an anomaly because, you know, for the rest of the season before that, I was playing pretty solidly and consistently, you know, getting some top 10s, top 15s. So just tried to ignore it as much as possible. And, you know, golf's unique that every week's a new week. So I just try and see it like that.
Lottie, anyone who's watching professional golf is seeing a lot of success from England. Yourself, Aaron Rye, Tommy Fleetwood, Charlie Hull, the Fitzpatrick brothers, Justin Rose. Do you sense that there is this tremendous wave of success coming from your country?
Yeah, definitely. I think everyone's been playing amazing from England, and it's great to see. Obviously, we'll competing out in the US, still representing England. So, yeah, it's really cool, especially this weekend with Aaron winning as well.
You're now number five in the Rolex rankings. Does it still feel real to you, given that a year ago you were just kind of trying to get ready for the NCAAs at that point? You're very early in your career, but have accomplished so much.
Yeah, I think yes and no. Definitely being out here, you know, being my job now, I've definitely gotten used to it. But yeah, I should be playing in nationals right now still. I actually ran into our FSU team in the airport yesterday in Atlanta. So it was quite funny to see them going off to play nationals. I'm like heading back from a tournament. So yeah, it does feel real, but also at the same time, I could definitely be on a different path.
You know, you're back in Tallahassee. My eyesight's not great, but that looks like a Florida State backpack behind you. You know, why haven't you made the big move to Jupiter? I don't know if Victor Hovland liked to stay in Stillwater even after he turned professional. Do you like being connected to FSU?
Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't been pro for a year yet, and there's been a lot of change, and I really haven't had time to think about moving elsewhere. I've been playing pretty much every week, so it's been easier to stay here at the moment, and our facilities are so good, and I mean, I'm still friends with everyone on the team because I could still be on the team with them. So it's kind of nice to come back and play with them.
You've yet to finish outside the top 10 in a major as a professional, Lottie. Has your mind started to drift towards getting back on a links course at Lytham for the AIG Women's Open later this year?
Yeah, I obviously love the AIG. haven't played Lynx Golf since last AIG, so we'll definitely have to go see the course before it. But yeah, I can't wait to play an Open in England. I haven't done that yet, so I think that would be really cool.
You've had great success in the Curtis Cup, in the Arnold Palmer Cup. What would you bring to a European Solheim Cup team should you make it, as I expect you will?
Yeah, I would love to make that team. I think in Europe, we're pretty lucky with our amateur golf. We play a lot of team events. I've played for England and Europe and obviously Palmer Cup, like you said. So kind of used to playing in a team environment and playing, you know, foursomes, four ball, and got some experience in that. So I hope we can bring that to it.
Well, we appreciate you taking some time out to talk with us today, Lottie. I'm sure we're going to have a lot of winners conversations down the road. Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Stick with the women's game. Check in on the Epson Tour, the road to the LPGA. Fiona Sue earned her second career win on the Epson Tour in the Copper Rock Championship, finishing the day 4-under to clear the field by 3 shots. Now, check this out. The last time Sue won on the Epson Tour was in her rookie season 2 years ago, where she not only won the Copper Rock Championship, but set the tour's 54-hole scoring record at 22-under. Now, with this win, she moves from 131 to 12 in the season-long race for the card. The top 10 players would punch their ticket to the LPGA.
Well, coming up next, we're checking in on this guy, the world number one, Scotty Scheffler. He won by 8 last year in Dallas. But what has he done for us lately? That's coming up.